Hello, and welcome to Science World. A SpaceX cargo ship safely delivered supplies to the International Space Station this week. But attempts here on Earth to safely land one of the spacecraft's rocket boosters on a barge failed. Philip Alexiou will have a report. This past week marked the 45th anniversary of the doomed Apollo 13 space mission. Kane Farabaugh talked with Apollo astronauts and NASA flight directors about what is referred to as NASA's most successful failure. And today we talk with a Virginia Tech scientist whose research team found that eating a high-fat diet, even for a period as little as 5 days, can play havoc with how our muscles process nutrients. And if the interruption of this process were allowed to continue, it could lead to the development of diabetes and other diseases. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A SpaceX cargo ship delivered supplies, including a new espresso maker, to the International Space Station this week. The spacecraft's launch went well, but another attempt to land the ship's rocket booster on a barge didn't go as planned. Science World's Philip Alexiou has more.
The SpaceX Corporation launched a spacecraft filled with supplies to the International Space Station on Tuesday, including the first ever espresso maker. But the private space exploration company's third attempt to land the leftover booster rocket on an ocean platform failed. The first stage booster rocket apparently landed too hard on the barge and tipped over. SpaceX chief Elon Musk wants to reuse the rockets rather than discard them in the ocean to reduce launch costs. The company will try again in June on the next supply run for NASA. During a previous landing attempt in January, the rocket ran out of hydraulic fluid for its steering fins, causing it to crash into the platform. A second attempt in February was called off because of high seas, but the rocket successfully ran through its pre-programmed landing sequence and hovered vertically above the waves before splashing down and breaking apart. For Science World, I'm Philip Alexiou.
A new smartphone-based device can diagnose the presence of cancer cells in a blood sample, Jessica Berman reports.
Diagnosing cancer usually involves the expertise of trained specialists called cytologists, high-powered microscopes, and other equipment. Cytologists look for cancer cells in a sample of blood or tissue obtained through a biopsy. Such technology and skilled personnel are not often available in rural settings, especially in Africa or Asia. But researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston have streamlined the process with a smartphone device that anyone can be trained to use. In a study involving 25 cell samples from women suspected of having cervical cancer, the cell phone's tiny camera came up with a preliminary diagnosis within 45 minutes, and it did so with near 100% accuracy, distinguishing high-risk cells from low-risk and non-cancerous cells. Cesar Castro is a medical oncologist at Mass General and lead author of the study. Castro says the phone records shadowy holographic-type images that are sent to and deciphered remotely by a computer.
The images get sent to a remote server, so through the wireless system, and a computer does the graphically intense processing that then recreates pretty much a high-resolution image of the cells and then potentially the presence or of beads. And so that if we see cells with beads decorated on them, then there's a suspicion that there's something not normal present in that sample.
Microscopic beads are added to the blood sample collected in a cube-shaped module attached tightly to the phone. The microbeads contain targeted antibodies or proteins that seek out cancerous cells. If they find any, the beads adhere to proteins on the outside of the cancerous cells. The small cube attached to the smartphone is called D3, the Digital Diffraction and Diagnosis System. It uses a battery-powered LED for illumination and is able to capture data from more than 100,000 cells in a sample. The test, according to Castro, can be performed by just about anyone.
This could be done whether it be in your local primary care office, whether it could be done even potentially at home, if we were to use other samples beyond biopsy, such as blood, for example, with a pink prick, not unlike the amount of blood that a diabetic would secure in order to read how much how high their sugars are. Down the line, we're working another alternative specimen, such as urine or saliva.
Castro says the test is very inexpensive, with a total cost of less than $2 for the module, battery, and microbeads. An article describing the D3 cancer detecting system is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This past week marked the 45th anniversary of the doomed Apollo 13 space mission. Kane Farabaugh spoke with the Apollo astronauts and NASA flight directors on how the aborted mission changed manned spaceflight and continues to influence space exploration today.
By the time NASA astronauts Jim Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert suited up for the Apollo 13 mission in April 1970, space travel, and even landing on the moon, had started to become a regular run-of-the-mill event.
Ignition, Fred.
But soon after liftoff, the Apollo 13 mission was anything but routine.
Houston, we've had a problem.
An oxygen tank exploded, crippling the spacecraft, forcing Jim Lovell to give up his dream of landing on the lunar surface.
I was very frustrated when I didn't land and I had to abort the flight.
What followed the initial explosion was three harrowing days as NASA flight engineers on the ground worked to bring the Apollo 13 crew safely back to Earth.
It was really a strong case of good leadership and teamwork. In fact, a classic case of crisis management.
Astronaut Michael Collins, who piloted the 1969 Apollo 11 mission that first landed on the moon, says Apollo 13 was a wake-up call.
It made NASA and the American public more aware of some of the hazards involved in flying to the moon and back.
Traveling to the moon did not end with Apollo 13. There were four more successful missions before the Apollo program ended in 1972. Jerry Griffin was a NASA flight director for the final moon landing.
I said, you know, we're on a roll in this country. We'll probably be at Mars in 20 years. That was 1972, which would have been 1992. And we didn't make it. So I'm surprised we haven't. It's a shame that we just haven't been able to get the national will and leadership to make it happen.
At Chicago's Adler Planetarium, the accomplishments of NASA's Gemini and Apollo missions are on display as part of a new exhibit titled Mission Moon. It showcases memorabilia from Lovell's career as an astronaut.
Quite a few of the population just here coming through the Adler Planetarium wasn't around when we actually did our Apollo flights.
Which is why Lovell wants to see NASA send astronauts back to the moon.
Once we're comfortable landing on the moon and exploring the moon, then I could think we should go to Mars. And that's, of course, years and years away, I think.
And even though Lovell never reached the moon, he has no regrets.
I'm now really happy that the 13 ended up the way it did. Because just think, if it was the third lunar landing flight, wouldn't have been all these celebrations we've had.
Hey, we've got a problem here.
And there might never have been a movie based on Lovell's extraordinary drama in space.
Houston, we have a problem.
The 1995 Tom Hanks film, entitled Apollo 13. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
It's time for this week's Science World Quick Quiz. As you just heard, this week marked the 45th anniversary of the doomed Apollo 13 mission. Along with Commander Jim Lovell and Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes, what was the name of the third crew member who served as the Command Module pilot aboard the ill-fated spacecraft? Was it A, Ken Mattingly, B, Gordon Cooper, or C, Jack Swigert? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
Listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog
can be found at voanews.com/science.
Californians seeking relief from serious drought conditions are looking at a number of ways to solve their water problems, including the use of ocean water. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
California's three-year-old drought has thrust seawater desalination into the spotlight as several cities push ahead with treatment plants that will soon turn the Pacific Ocean into a source of drinking water. The biggest ocean desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere, a $1 billion project under construction since 2012 on a coastal lagoon in the southern city of Carlsbad, will deliver water to the San Diego area when it begins operating this November. Desalination has emerged as a newly promising technology in California in the face of a record dry spell that has depleted reservoirs, forced tough new conservation measures, and raised the cost of importing fresh water from elsewhere. But Matt O'Malley, the policy director of San Diego Coastkeeper, a local environmental group, warns that converting seawater to drinking supplies is an expensive, energy-intensive enterprise.
Yeah, desal is by far, at this point, still the most expensive source of water, and that's because it's tied so closely with energy, because it is such a high energy-intense water source. And so we put ourselves in a cycle where we're paying more for water because we're paying more for energy, and that energy is greenhouse gas intense. So that's why we think that we need to look more towards conservation and recycling as the priorities here.
Critics of desalination have also cited environmental drawbacks, such as harmed marine life from intake pipes that suck water into the treatment plants and the concentrated brine that gets discharged back into the ocean. Another 15 to 17 seawater desalting plants are in the design or planning phase around the state. The city of Santa Barbara is taking steps to modernize and reactivate a much smaller $34 million desalination plant built during an earlier drought but mothballed after a trial run in 1992 when that water crisis abated. I'm Doug Bernard for Science World.
Meanwhile, normally rainy Taiwan is also rationing water to ease its worst drought in a decade. The government has cut household and industrial use until rainfall returns to normal. Ralph Jennings has this report from Taipei.
Low rainfall over the past year has led Taiwan's central government to ration water, saving about 500,000 tons so far. In parts of northern Taiwan, households are now able to receive tap water just 5 days a week, prompting some to store up in advance. About 800,000 households had been affected as of March. In industrial regions, factories are recycling water and cutting back on air conditioning. Water Resources Agency spokesman Lai Jianxin blames a shift in ocean temperatures for rainfall of just 1,643 millimeters last year. He says that, of course, part of the reason is related to temperatures of the Pacific Ocean, and that a cold, dry band of air has been aimed at Taiwan, resulting in a trend of low rainfall all of last year. Officials decided in November, after monitoring water levels for 2 months, to begin rationing supplies. Rationing affects all or part of 9 cities and counties along Taiwan's densely populated west coast. In the city of Taoyuan, part of New Taipei City, and part of Hsinchu County, households and businesses go without tap water 2 days per week. The drought has unleashed criticism over suspected leaky pipes and reservoirs that are too old or too clogged with silt to hold whatever rain falls. Sherman Reservoir, which serves much of northern Taiwan, was at about a quarter of capacity as of April 8. Low-flush, low-flow bathroom equipment is also rare on the island of 23 million people. Lai, with the Taiwan Water Resources Agency, says the government wants to double the amount of dredging now so reservoirs can hold more water. He says the agency is always continuing to carry out this kind of work. But due to the drought situation, Lai says, authorities are moving toward the biggest reservoir dredging measures ever, with a goal of at least doubling the average level they have normally dredged in the past. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou said last month that by May he would try and head off a water shortage that would more seriously affect common households. He also called for better management of Taiwan's water. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
According to BirdLife International, 1 in 8 of the world's bird species is threatened with extinction. Among those in danger are two tiny Hawaiian bird species called honeycreepers. Scientists at the San Diego Zoo said they were able to hatch a half dozen of honey creeper chicks in captivity, raising hopes that the birds will flutter back from the brink of extinction. George Putich reports.
Akikiki and Akikee, two species of honey creepers, make their nests high in the trees of dense rainforests on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, camouflaging them as clumps of moss. Avian malaria, loss of native habitat, hurricanes, and non-native predators have devastated their population. Losing them would mean losing a special part of Hawaii, says Brice Masuda, program manager of the Hawaii Endangered Bird Conservation Program.
Akikiki and Akikee are found only on the island of Kauai and could become extinct in a few years without intensive conservation intervention.
Members of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project found several eggs from both species after a long search. They were carefully collected and transported by helicopter to a conservation facility where they were placed in an incubator. So far, six chicks have hatched and are doing well. Masuda says this is the best way for recovering the population of endangered birds.
By bringing Akikiki and Akikee into captivity for breeding purposes, we'll be able to prevent these two species from going extinct and will be able to support their long-term recovery by eventually releasing captive-reared individuals back out into the wild again.
Scientists plan to continue with the program throughout the breeding season. The same method was successfully used by the Hawaii Endangered Bird Conservation Program for increasing populations of other endangered birds on the islands. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
So, do you think you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz? Let's find out. We were looking for the name of the Apollo 13 crew member that flew with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes aboard the ill-fated spacecraft. Was it A, Ken Mattingly, B, Gordon Cooper, or C, Jack Swigert? The answer is C. John L. Swigert, better known as Jack Swigert, had been tapped as a backup astronaut for the mission. But after original Apollo 13 crew member Ken Mattingly was grounded just 3 days before the launch by NASA's flight surgeon, Jack Swigert was brought in as Mattingly's replacement. Swigert joined Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes on the historic mission. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Despite numerous warnings from health professionals, a number of people, especially those in the most developed nations, still consume a diet that is high in fat. But a new study from scientists at Virginia Tech shows that eating a high-fat diet, even for a short period of time, can quickly trigger serious changes in the way our body's muscles metabolize nutrients. The researchers found that after just 5 days on a high-fat diet, the ability of our muscles to oxidize glucose, a process that releases needed cellular energy after eating a meal, is disrupted. This is something the scientists say could lead to the inability of our bodies to respond to insulin, which then could lead to the development of diabetes and other diseases. Matt Hulver, an associate professor of human nutrition, foods, and exercise in the Virginia Tech College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, led the study. He joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and findings. What do you consider to be a high-fat diet?
Well, what we used was a 55% fat diet, so that means 55% of the calories that our research participants consumed was fat. And our interest has predominantly been the effects of saturated fat. And saturated fat was a little less than half of the 55%, but it was 25% of the total calories consumed came from saturated fat.
So what kind of foods were your test subjects eating?
So predominantly it was more prepackaged, processed type foods that would need to go into the microwave to heat up. To get to the saturated fat level that we desired to test, there was a significant amount of butter included in the diet.
You assert after 5 days of eating a high-fat diet that the body begins to change how it processes nutrients. Can you explain that?
So we did a few measures. The two that I'll kind of highlight the most is we do the muscle biopsy and we take that sample back to my lab and we essentially process it where we'll expose it to radio-labeled glucose. And so glucose is, you know, a fancy name for sugar. And we'll look at the ability for that muscle to oxidize or use that glucose to produce energy. And so prior to high-fat feeding, we would do muscle biopsies before a meal, and then we did it 4 hours afterwards. And you would normally expect the muscle to utilize that glucose in response to a meal quite robustly, and it did. But what we saw after 5 days of the high saturated fat feeding, that the ability for that muscle to use or oxidize that glucose was significantly impaired.
Why do these changes take place so quickly after only 5 days?
We don't have an answer to this point of what are the, you know, the molecular mechanisms behind these robust changes that we're seeing. Those are some follow-up studies we plan to start looking at mechanism. But I would have to say, you know, we were quite surprised that we saw these changes as well in as little as 5 days. One question we continually get when people see these results is, well, how long do the effects last? Would they persist or would they return quickly? You know, I would speculate and I would hypothesize that if we would take these same individuals and put them back on their control diet, which is low fat, higher carbohydrate, that they would resort back to normal. We have some plans to do some follow-up studies where we will do just that and place them back on a controlled low-fat diet, do the same test again 5 days later, seeing if they do return to normal or if that persists. But the persistence of these findings is unknown to this point. We haven't done that follow-up testing yet, but it is planned.
How else would eating a high-fat diet impact the body and increase health risks?
One thing you have to realize on our study is, you know, when you think about, I'm sure you've probably heard of the term, the so-called westernized diet or Americanized type diet. When we talk about that type of diet, it's generally high sugar, it's high fat, but it's also generally higher in calories than what your typical human would need as far as energy. What's important to point out is we purely wanted to look at the effect of increasing the amount of fat in the diet independent of weight gain. So we didn't increase their calories. We matched their calorie consumption to what they would consume habitually. So they gained no weight. What could happen long term, say it was high calorie, high fat, is you would expect the body to become resistant to the effects of insulin. That's something termed insulin resistance, which is a risk factor for the development of type 2 diabetes. Weight gain would typically ensue with high calories and high fat. In our study, it's different because we didn't ramp up the calories. We kept the calories constant and just increased the fat. But theoretically, if someone is in energy balance, they're not consuming more calories than they need, they should not gain weight, and a lot of the evidence would suggest that weight gain needs to ensue to have long-term ramifications like insulin resistance. So, you know, ours was 5 days. I can't really comment on what if we would have kept these guys on this for another 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Would we have begun to see the effects in the shape of insulin resistance? Perhaps so, but we don't have any evidence for that at this point.
As you and your colleagues conducted the experiments and have gone through your research, did you come across anything that surprised you?
Two things. When our initial studies, we just took muscle biopsies under fasting conditions. And interestingly, 5 days of high-fat feeding, we didn't see any effects on the metabolism on the muscle samples obtained under those conditions. What really highlighted the effects of this is we decided to stress the system by feeding a meal and then looking at the muscle metabolism in a fasted state and then 4 hours into a fed state. So that was surprising, where just stressing the system is what really brought out the major effects of this 5 days of high-fat feeding. I don't think we expected to see so consistently across all subjects these robust changes in how muscle metabolizes glucose in just as little as 5 days. So I think those findings in themselves were surprising to us.
That was Matt Hulver from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our webpage and blog. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Our web address is voanews.com/science. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.